Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
MM LaFleur is a women's workwear brand whose mission is to take the work out of dressing for work.
Finally.
Each MM LaFleur customer... Well, yeah, of course. Each MM LaFleur customer works one-on-one with an MM stylist who helps her build her work wardrobe in a systematic, personalized way. MM LaFleur takes the work out of dressing for work by offering luxurious, pragmatic clothing and personal styling to today's busy professional women. I'll just say it works for me too, although I don't think of myself as especially professional. I do love these clothes. They are almost all machine washable, which is great. They defy wrinkling, which is also great. Because I don't know about you, John, when you dress for travel.
When I dress for travel. I dress like it's the 1960s and I'm getting on a Braniff flight, and so I put on a full suit.
Well, that's good. Well, see, I actually do like to dress up just a little bit, you know, because I don't leave the house much in general. So like when I do leave the house, like I treat it like a special occasion a lot of the time. And MM LaFleur stuff does genuinely work. They sent me some things to try. I actually bought some MM LaFleur stuff before they even sponsored the show. And I genuinely love it. If you see me on television, sometimes I am wearing MM LaFleur stuff.
Fantastic.
And the coolest thing about it though is, I haven't gotten to yet, which is the personal styling. You work with someone and you tell them what you need. And if you have specific dressing needs, like if you're traveling a lot, if you need sleeves to, say, cover your tattoos on television, or work pants that, you know, have pockets, or dresses with pockets, which is a thing that a lot of women are looking for and are weirdly hard to find. It is not a subscription service.
If I were to ask for my look, it would be social media billionaire. I want to dress like I have fuck you money, even though I do not.
But you already wear a hoodie, right?
Like, right,
isn't
that's
the
thing.
The only...
It's
so much easier for guys. If women just wore hoodies and jeans all the time, I don't think they'd be like marked as like up and coming billionaires. I think they'd be told that, you know, why don't you look nicer today? Anyway.
And maybe that's why that criminal wore that black turtleneck.
This is getting away from the subject, which is that these are cool clothes. It's not a subscription service. There's no commitment. You won't be charged anything up front. And these things, the box that you order is called a bento box. And once it arrives, you have 4 days to try on everything. And then you keep what you like and send back the rest. It's completely free. There's no like styling fee, which some subscription services have. And there's no commitment. So you can try a bento box yourself. Visit mmbento.com. That is mmbento.com. Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These. We have a really great and important show today. I'm talking to Tim Faust, who is a healthcare policy expert you may have heard on another little liberal-leaning podcast called Chapo Trap House. That is where I first started paying attention to him. He is one of the most engaging healthcare policy experts I've ever talked to. His passion really sets him apart from a lot of the people that you might be seeing on TV these days. And I think also what sets him apart is his willingness to call bullshit on bullshit and his willingness to explicate the really progressive options we have when it comes to healthcare. Towards the end of the episode, we get into something called healthcare justice or health justice. He's the first person I ever heard talk about that. It's a kind of new way of thinking about healthcare policy that I think is important and will become more important as liberals and progressives try to steer this ship of state away from the large orange iceberg that it's currently pointed at. Or who's driving. One of the two. I've totally lost the metaphor. In any case, Tim Faust. Welcome, Tim Faust, to the show. Hi.
Hello. Good to be here.
Hi. So you are a healthcare amateur turned somewhat professional. You're now studying it, and you're touring the country doing explainers about single payer. Right?
That's right. I worked on ACA enrollment in 2013 in Florida. I ran some canvases there. And kind of Florida's a Medicaid non-expansion state. So there's a lot of folks who I had to go to work every day and explain to folks, hey, I'm so sorry, you're not quite poor enough to receive the subsidies or to receive Medicaid, or you're the wrong kind of poor because there's additional restrictions, but you don't make enough money to receive subsidies, premium subsidies through the ACA. So you've just kind of been forgotten. And having to explain that to folks over and over and over again was kind of messed me up. And I wanted to figure out, well, why do we permit this to happen? Like how does a democratically elected person actively choose to fail their own constituencies in like a pretty nakedly explicit way for their own political benefit? And so I wanted to figure out why that happened. And I've been researching or working in healthcare since. And after Trump got elected, I reckoned it was time to probably take that kind of out of myself and begin using it, talking to folks, fighting for single payer more explicitly. When this is all said and done, I'd love to work for Medicaid. But for now, I think I'm spending a lot of my time trying to get folks amped up to work on single payer, building movements, building coalitions, building canvases. So yeah, doing a 15-city tour between New York and Minneapolis in October, and then Florida to Texas and West Coast sometime next year as well. Just kind of talking about single payer, what it is, why it's good, and how it's just the first step in a long process of getting what we actually want.
Well, you know, speaking of wanting to work for Medicaid, that's an optimistic viewpoint, I think, because aren't we right now in the middle of yet another battle over whether Medicaid is going to even continue to exist? This Cassidy Graham bill that is in the headlines right now, that is the no, really, this time, no, really, we're going to repeal ACA. Like, it has Medicaid, like, in its sights, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, the conservatives, or the GOP, and for a long time, the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, have had Medicaid reform, entitlement reform, kind of in their scope, lined up Chris Kyle-like for 30, 40 years. It manifests in all these different and perverse ways, from things like the Clinton welfare reforms in the 90s to Cassidy Graham, which is just pretty explicitly an assault on the poor and the vulnerable in the U.S. Now, Cassidy Graham is the last in like a line of terrible bills, and a lot of the tricks in this one aren't particularly new. It does have one really particularly stupid new wrinkle inside of it, which is a redistribution of Medicaid funds across states, or a reallocation of Medicaid funds across states. But fundamentally, like the core song remains the same. They want to roll back as many of the good reforms of the ACA as possible, and just gut the entire idea of an entitlement program, and really kind of undermine federal ability to mandate state expenses on covering uncovering people. So it sucks. But there's a pretty good chance it doesn't pass, right? Because the ones before it haven't passed, and this one is somehow even worse thought out than the rest of them. But we do live in the Enrique Iglesias zone now, where nothing is forbidden anymore. So, I mean, the smart money would have said Trump wouldn't have gotten elected, and that didn't work out so good. So, of course, any threat to the to healthcare in America has to be taken seriously. I just hope this thing is like shucked, gutted, and left for dead sooner rather than later, so we can get working on the actual thing, so we can get started on the actual work.
I feel like there's a lot of places that are explaining sort of the specific bad things about this bill, you know, from it would outlaw, you know, coverage that included abortion starting next year. It would eliminate any kind of opioid epidemic funding. I could just go a laundry list. Do you want to say a favorite thing, bad thing that it does? Because there's a long, long list, right?
Yeah. So there's, I mean, it's, you know, any bad guy that's ever had an idea in the past 7 years about how to repeal or get rid of part of the ACA or make healthcare harder to get for people to better subsidize corporate interests kind of like got their shot.
Right.
Everybody threw all their darts at the dartboard and they scraped it off and said, here's the bill. Yeah. The bill is divided
into two sections. This is the expanded universe version of
right.
ACA repeal.
This is a the Spider-Man rogues galleries of terrible people with terrible ideas.
Right. And so like no pre-existing conditions, no essential health benefits. I'm only naming these things because I do feel like probably listeners of this program, if they're Pod Save America listeners, like have a sort of basic understanding about this bill is bad.
Well, yes.
But I want to get to what I want to get to with you is actually sort of the way that it's bad in the thinking behind it.
Right.
And the way that it sort of is trying to force people to think about the way that we do healthcare in America. I said this to you before the show, but I feel like we've been on, kind of despite ourselves, a leftward trending understanding of healthcare. You know, like the ACA was a part of that. And Cassidy Graham is like, no, like throw themselves in the tracks to like shift the thinking into this really mercenary view of the way that healthcare should work.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the paleo-conservative what healthcare is, right? The idea of individual accountability reigning supreme, the idea that you should be saddled with the cost of your own healthcare, even though we know, and we've known since the 1880s, that nobody can afford the cost of their own healthcare. So Cassidy Graham focuses on non-Medicaid reforms, just kind of rolling back in individual parts of the ACA. It doesn't have an express rollback of pre-existing conditions or essential health benefits, but it lets states file waivers to let them do it themselves. States' rights is just here a slogan for letting states write their own more easily lobbied reforms to the policy to harm people. Then it's got a bunch of Medicaid, a full-on kind of full-throated assault on Medicaid. It terminates the ACA Medicaid expansions. It takes eliminates retroactive eligibility, which is I'm on Medicaid. I get hit by a car on January 1st, or I'm poor. I'm eligible for Medicaid, but I'm not on Medicaid. I get hit by a car on January 1st. Right now, like in the before times, you can still enroll in Medicaid afterward to get your bills covered, which is obvious. Providers want that so they can get money. People want that because they can't afford their own healthcare costs. That's being scrapped, and it distributes Medicaid as a block grant. A block grant is a big chunk of money, a fixed amount of money that changes year over year, kind of on a fixed rate, appointed ahead of time. That's just given to money, just given to states, and states are told, do what you will with this. This is a really, really different model of financing Medicaid than what we currently have, the entitlement program.
It's a really different model of like even understanding quote unquote insurance. And I use insurance the word loosely because one of the motivations behind this bill seems to be to kind of make people forget that the whole point of insurance is that the people who don't need it pay for the people who need it. Like that.
Right. half of all medical spending comes from the care of 5% of people, right? People in general don't get sick. The idea of a risk pool is that you've got a bunch of people and most of them don't get sick at all. And some of them get sick. And of those that get sick, some get really sick and some just get kind of sick. And so you can pool all your money together and use that to pay for the care of people that get sick. And also by having such a large pool, you can do a lot of things that a monopsony, which is like a single buyer in a market, can do. Like pull down costs to a just level, use the act of paying to kind of enforce standards and enforce procedures and guidelines. And like generally everybody understands this is how insurance worked. We had a before time.
You say everyone generally understands how that's how insurance worked, but it seems like the senators who are endorsing this bill like literally are trying to say that insurance doesn't work that way.
I mean, that's a particularly perverse phenomenon.
Yeah.
We've already had this experiment of individual accountability. It was the Gilded Era. It was you had to either like have a family doctor that you paid for because you were aristocratic, or you had to go like beg at the free clinic, or you had to be like saddled under a lifetime of debt. Jeff Stein at Vox, who I like quite a bit, performed an interview with, I think, 9 senators who were mm-hmm. backing Cassidy Graham earlier today. Today is Wednesday the 20th.
Yeah.
And none of these folks can fucking articulate a single defense, not even a defense, can articulate a single reason to really advocate for Cassidy Graham. It's purely a political maneuver, which is really the most, I think, what you're talking before, one of the most disturbing things about the entire bill, right? Like, it insists kind of nakedly and falsely that it's intended to help the vulnerable. Like, Cassidy Graham, like, the language around Cassidy Graham is attempting to, like, oh, we need to help these states that didn't expand Medicaid, and therefore, like, they've got a population that's sicker and poor, not getting care, and like, why are only four states getting a third of the ACA money? And it ignores fundamentally the reason for why that happened, right? Like, the reason not all states expanded Medicaid is because a lot of governors like Rick Perry and a lot of legislatures like the Florida legislature chose not to do so as a way to give the finger to Obama.
Right. It was literally to spite Obama. It was not out of any kind of like reasoned policy, you know, argument. It was right. It was literally just to say fuck you to Obama and that's it. And I also noticed that they're kind of using this language of individualization and also protecting people to defend this bill. Literally, this is something Cassidy said: where you live should not determine how healthy you are. Which
right. I mean,
I agree. Sure. You
know? They've done a very good job at like saying, because a cool thing that's happened is we saw with the BCRA and every other fucking variation of this abomination that appears before us. People go and they go and protest and they go and protest their senators. Mitch McConnell gets yelled at, which is great. He should be yelled at literally all the time. Every politician should be yelled at literally all the time until they do good things. And they're getting shook, so they're adopting the language. I think the most egregious example is Cassidy talking to Jimmy Kimmel, uh-huh. saying like, "Oh yeah, like nobody should have to be burdened with care they can't pay for," and then doing an immediate 180 and advancing this thing instead, right? And so they're pointing at the problem, right? They're pointing at the problem of saying, "Hey, healthcare distribution, healthcare payment in across the states is not equal," and they're choosing to ignore entirely that the reason these things are imbalanced are of their own machination and are entirely reversible by just accepting free money. It was a free federal funds matching program that expanded Medicaid for people under 138 FPL and removed kinds of means testing across the board, and they denied it now. And so that's brutal. That's savage. Like this is an intentional act of failing a constituency and condemning folks to live in fear of their own bodies. At the same, so that the Republicans, you know, I hope every single one of them sees the millions of ghosts that they're creating, and if there is an afterlife, I hope they get some kind of retribution, because they're not going to get it here, because capital protects its own. At the same time, like this is obviously the causes of these problems, and the people who are at fault for this wave of mutilation across the U.S. are entirely within the GOP, but. Or also, it is worth noting that the mechanism through which the mm-hmm. ACA was created did create this leave this vulnerability available, right? By expanding Medicaid, which does have a partial state funding, like states got to pay for their own programs, and removing, rolling back some of the Clinton era welfare reforms, which are all predicated on the idea of wanting to find the deserving versus the undeserving poor and separate them. There's this big fear in healthcare policy and not a lot of welfare policy, safety net policy, that like giving somebody who's not quite poor enough a little bit of help is terrible, and we can't ever have that happen. So instead,
I would say that's a fear. That's a rhetorical feint by conservatives and centrists. And neoliberals, that it's not right. actually a real concern
because we give
companies shit they don't deserve all the time, right? Like we give people things they don't deserve all the time.
Right. We only care about like this very, very petty bean counting and means right. testing and finding the worthy and the unworthy.
If you're already poor, that's the only thing we care about. If you're already poor, we don't want you to get something you don't deserve. But if you're middle class and you want to write off your mortgage, sure. You know,
I mean, shit.
We don't care.
If you make 6-7 figures a year, like we don't even have tax brackets invented for you yet.
Yeah,
it's pretty naked, and it's two-facedness.
And I don't want to get too far into it, but I also want to point out, because I think it's a good piece of history for us liberals to be aware of, people who consider themselves Democrats, that this whole bill, Cassidy Graham, is based on Rick Santorum's understanding of the Clinton welfare reform. Act. right? Like right. That its whole structure actually is based on a Clinton era proposal that most of us now realize was bad, but
A lot of folks realized it was bad at the time as well, right? It was an attempt to solve a problem that didn't exist.
It was a deserving poor issue. It was exactly the same.
20 years later, we've made the most vulnerable even more vulnerable. Maybe we shouldn't do that ever again. And so like this kind of like dragon scale approach of we're going to find like these little buckets of people that are deserving of this amount of money. And you need to we're going to build a sliding scale that has it's a very technocratic solution, right? Mm-hmm. And technocracy loves technocracy more than it loves anything else. It loves the idea of we're going to build this big puzzle to solve. And that creates vulnerabilities, right? That creates gaps and cracks. And people fall through these cracks. And these cracks are then used as leverage points by the bad guys when they want to dismantle the entire thing. A federally funded single payer, which just treats everybody as being in the same risk pool, doesn't have the same kinds of problems that prompted the NFIB versus Sebelius lawsuit, which unprecedentedly was successful and then gave the states the ability to deny Medicaid expansion, right? I don't mean to Monday morning quarterback it, but the entire like means-tested structure of the ACA is what gave the states the ability to deny Medicaid expansion, which has caused all of these problems, which are now being used to advocate for Graham Cassidy.
Right, and it's also what created kind of the coverage gap problems that a lot of people point to when they say that ACA is not working.
Yep.
Those coverage gaps exist because of means testing. And those coverage gaps exist because ACA is not generous enough, not because it's too generous. These days, you can get practically everything on demand.
It's true.
Like this podcast.
True.
It is true. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. I understand some people listen to podcasts on even like sped up time, which I haven't progressed quite to.
Give 1.2 speed a try, and you'll all of a sudden people in the real world will be talking like they're on drugs. Slow.
Yes, and also I guess you can increase your podcast listening by like point, you know, by a factor of 1.2.
It does sort of beg the question though, which is like, why are you doing this? If you're just trying to get through shit, well, like it's supposed to be both informative and entertaining. So like at a certain point, you're going so fast that it's like, why? Just don't listen. You know, it's sort of like when when you can skip a level.
If you're
in a
not
video
enjoying
game.
It, don't listen. If you're not enjoying it, don't listen.
You can skip this level on this video game. But you know what you can also do is skip the whole thing.
Sort of like stamps.com offers you the opportunity to skip the post office. Is that what you're trying to say?
That was good.
Yes.
Stamps.com. Skip the post office.
Stamps.com. You can skip the post office. You can get postage on demand. Anything you can do at the post office. I mean, I think you and I could probably come up with some stuff that you can do at the post office that you can't do at your desk. But anything that you would involving
watching,
postage.
Waiting on
postage.
Long lines. Looking for parking. These are all things that you can't do in your home.
Telling a civil servant that you appreciate their service, which is something I try to do at the post office.
Turning into a radical right-wing conservative for the 10 minutes you're inside.
But you can do it from your desk. You can still do that at your desk, I guess.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But
people do.
With stamps.com.
Stamps.com.
Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And of course, unlike the post office, it never closes. You can get postage whenever you need it.
Sweet.
And if you would like, you can use my code FRIENDS for a special offer. 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. It's my code FRIENDS at stamps.com for a special offer. 4 weeks for free and a digital scale. You, I think, click on the radio microphone.
You do.
On the corner.
Click on the microphone.
So.
The code is FRIENDS.
Yeah.
Stamps.com.
And never go to the post office
Go to the post office again.
So we've done, I think, you know, we kind of traveled through Cassidy Graham a little bit, and you mentioned some of the things that have led up to this moment, like mainly in the most recent past, like, you know, the structure of Cassidy Graham kind of looks like welfare reform, intentionally so. And we've also, you said Monday morning quarterback the ACA a bit. But I've always been fascinated by the fact that Americans don't seem to realize like how fucked up our healthcare system is. Like, or they realize it, but they think it's just everyone's fucked up that same way. But we're not. Like, it's pretty uniquely fucked up
way.
You know, God bless us. It is a uniquely fucked up healthcare system. Do you want to do just a Reader's Digest, if possible, version of like how we got here?
Yeah, I'll keep it super brief. The idea of insurance began in Germany under Otto von Bismarck, who... I don't know why you laugh.
I'm up for anything that begins with Otto von Bismarck. I'm up for it.
So he was super afraid of socialism, right? Hopefully we can bring that fear back. He was afraid that the socialists would take over and do things like give healthcare to people.
And that people would respond to that. He was afraid of socialism because it would be appealing to people. Let's be very clear. Like what he was scared of was not like creeping socialism because just some generalization of socialism is bad, but because he saw that he saw the appeal of it.
Right. And it articulated relief from things that Bismarck needed in order to maintain power. So he developed in the 1880s a compulsory social health insurance program, in which employers and employees split costs of buying into an insurance pool. You might recognize this from a lot of the ways that employer-based insurance works in the U.S. And that kind of set the people that employed labor and labor themselves had skin in the game, so to speak. And together they put together these social health insurance funds. Eventually they were expanded to cover all people, regardless of whether they were working or not. But it kind of built the idea of what insurance can be and where money comes from. Cool. In the U.S., we had a similar kind of agitation, but nowhere near as realized, right? We had a bunch of folks who were sick. We realized that illness forced people into poverty. We didn't yet have like the staggering level of medical debt that a person can accrue back then. But certainly we had the idea, we had the lived experience that people could get sick and through their sickness be compelled into poverty. And being poor in 1890 is probably still worse than being poor in 2017, although it's still pretty brutal today. And so there's a lot of progressive agitation for welfare reform, right? Under Theodore Roosevelt, you've got labor, you've got the Progressive Party that wanted to, in their own words, eliminate sickness as a cause of poverty. And so they kind of built a prototype of the insurance model. You've got buy-in from the employers, the employees in the state, and that all was thrown out the window when Wilson built Roosevelt. In 32, but even doctors were saying, man, this is enough. Like, we can't afford to like get our incomes because we don't have enough patients that can afford to pay for us. We don't like having to work in hospitals where we watch the sick and the dying grow sicker and have to cast them out. This sucks. So a group of doctors formed a thing called the Committee on the Cost of Medical Care, which was independently funded, which wanted to look at, well, where do costs come from? Why do prices grow? Why can't anybody afford to pay their healthcare bills? And that document really served as the intellectual underpinning of modern American health insurance. Of course, the AMA then threw it immediately under the bus and chose not to advocate for it.
How was it the framework for modern insurance? If it got thrown under the bus, was it the framework for modern like government paid for health insurance? This idea that we're going to it sounds a little bit like Medicaid or Medicare.
It explained the idea of, oh, like no one can afford to pay for. Cause so before in this before era, before the Committee on Cost of Medical Care, everybody had to pay out of pocket for all their own stuff. Right. There was no risk pool. There was nobody else to pool your money with. It was just if you've got a big bag of like various silver coins or whatever, and you use those to pay for your tuberculosis or other Dongerman's grip, whatever old timey disease that you have.
Gout. That always seems like a Gilded Age disease.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a combination of black lung and gout, and you need to pay for it to the doctor who comes to your house with a big bag of silver coins. The idea of like building organizations that help take care of funding for healthcare or building risk pools didn't really exist at all in the U.S. That's what the Committee on the Cost of Medical Care put together. And it advocated for the idea of, well, we can do this and actually, I don't know if I don't have my notes on the actual CMC report in front of me. Just that it put together like a vision for how healthcare can be recognized, how a national insurance program can work. A lot of that was based on the Bismarck model. The AMA threw it under the bus, chose not to advocate for it because they had price controls. Right. One of the best thing, like the AMA has been for most of its entire life, a way to fix prices. One of its very first acts when it got together after the Civil War was to tell traveling doctors what the floor for procedures was so that it could keep costs consistent across the U.S., which of course leads to price inflation in a country where people are suffering from like the ravages of the Civil War. And that's kind of where things sat for a while until Blue Cross formed in, I think, outside Dallas or Fort Worth. Blue Cross was a collaboration between teachers unions in the area and a local hospital. And they kind of pioneered the model of, okay, well, like with a given provider group and a given union or a given like employer employee group, we'll all pool our costs together. We can use them at this hospital. And it wasn't very comprehensive. Like it wasn't like a very extensive healthcare program, but it was based on kind of the employer-employee or rather the union model. And it was associated with facility. It was associated with the Blue Cross hospitals in Dallas. After World War II, as the story goes, the government instituted a wage freeze. And so employers looking for ways to kind of juice their benefits packages to pull more people into working for them began adding insurance as a form of non-wage compensation. That got passed through the IRS. So they got a tax break for that, which is one of the biggest expenses in healthcare in the U.S. And over time, that became kind of a cornerstone of how insurance is allocated through your employer. Over the past 60, 70 years, it's been used, like there's been recalcitrance to develop a national model on various sides. At one point, unions didn't want to expand insurance didn't want to build a national insurance program because union-based employer insurance was like a very, very good carrot to have and a great way to build union membership. The AMA's fought it consistently the entire time. And as we develop this insurance industry, they've also obviously been loath to give up their entire industry for the benefit of the population. That kind of brings us to where we are now, where we've got this very, very patchwork way of how people get insurance for healthcare. In the 60s, we recognized that, oh shit, well, like fundamentally paying for the healthcare costs of people that are sick or old or not working isn't very profitable at all. Like taking care of sick people is not a money-making endeavor. So this coalition permitted the state to introduce the idea of Medicaid and Medicare, which are federal programs in the case of Medicare and federal state programs in the case of Medicaid that take care of people that are of a certain age or are under a certain income. And there were plans to expand that to include young people, which is particularly salient now because I think a lot of people are shackled to jobs they don't want to have or jobs that are bad to them because they have kids, then you got to pay for the healthcare or the insurance cost of those kids. But those plans were gutted by incrementalists almost immediately. And so we can't afford to make a profit off taking care of these people. Let's have the federal government subsidize it was kind of the modus operandi for the past half century. You can see that in the ACA as well. We've got a bunch of people that were uninsured because they weren't employed or their employers weren't offering insurance. And so the ACA was intended to build a program through which the federal government would basically bribe insurers through mass subsidies by paying off their premiums so that these folks could get insured instead of covering them through a federal program.
Right. And what the ACA did, if I can just jump in a little bit, because I think the mindset issue here, if I borrow for a term, is that the ACA perpetuated the idea that of deservingness, right? Like that there were some people that were poor, but were working hard and deserve to have health care. So we're going to take care of them. And it also, if anything, kept people thinking that employer-based health insurance was a good thing. Like it emphasized the whole, like, if you like your plan, you can keep it rhetoric, which whatever, true or not, like that's what that was about. And it made you, that was the norm, that enshrined that as the norm, that you should be getting your health care through your insurer. And these are the things that it should cover. And what the government is there to do is right, to make sure you have good insurance, not necessarily to be on your side.
And non-employer insurance is a kind of the accident, not the rule. Yeah, there's three things on that. One, like the ACA did do some really, really cool stuff. I gotta you gotta recognize when a good thing happens. When the ACA, like, there's this neoliberal tendency, right, of treating healthcare as a commodity. Healthcare isn't a commodity because you don't go to the store and buy a 6-pack of healthcare. It's not a thing like beer or bubblegum or Diet Coke or whatever, where you can buy a quantity of it and like you can and increase that quantity over time. Healthcare is not a commodity. Healthcare is a thing that it doesn't have a normal curve, right? People aren't smart shoppers,
right,
when it comes to healthcare costs. They when their bodies fall apart because we're just big bags of goo we don't understand, people need care and they don't have the ability to price shop or be a smart shopper.
And also, and this is another big flaw in our system, is that everyone's healthcare is slightly different. And that your form of, you know, kidney disease might respond differently to my form of kidney disease, and different things might work for both of us.
Great example of that is HIV/AIDS, which has a list of like right. 16 drugs that can be combined in various forms to create the cocktail and treat them.
And other countries treat it that way. They bill per disease, right?
Right. Well, we have Medicare does that in the U.S.
And Medicaid does that in the U.S. But employer-based health insurance, it's all, you know, just incremental little fees.
Right. It's the fee-for-service model where you go to the doctor and you want to, I don't know, like get your hand measured or something. I don't know what people do at doctors. And so the doctor charges you for the ruler, charges you for the Band-Aid, charges you for the tape.
Right.
And all these things are put together in a line item and then negotiated with your insurer to get the actual cost and then paid for on that SKU-based fee-for-service model. So wherever wherever the ACA acted against this neoliberal tendency, the commoditization of healthcare, permitting a for-profit model, subsidizing insurers, like it only fed into this kind of broken ideological bent. But where it acted against that, Medicaid expansion, unilaterally good, defining essential health benefits, like saying here is what healthcare is and here's what healthcare is not, an insurance plan to be adequately an insurance plan to be adequate must contain coverage for these kinds of care. That's a unilaterally good thing. The definition of, or the introduction of pre-existing conditions, like into fucking common vernacular, is a unilaterally good thing. These things are good. These things act.
I'm going to summarize here, which is that the most socialist parts of the ACA were the most successful parts. The most generous, most socialisty parts were the parts that people like.
Exactly.
And the parts that people want to keep. It's the market-based stuff that people have a problem with and that is not working.
100%.
Still.
You're exactly right. Like where the ACA bucked the tendency that of how healthcare works in the U.S., it was successful and people love it. And that's really important to fight for. Where it like perpetuated the commoditization of healthcare or the neoliberal motto is where it's beginning to show, or where it did show its faults and its failings, right? And that's a bummer.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm going to move us to what hopefully comes next, right? So if we can agree and we can prove it's the most socialisty parts of the ACA that work, it's the most market parts that people have a problem with, that is where Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill comes in.
Absolutely. So, yes.
It says, let's take the parts of the ACA that work, which Medicare expansion, Medicaid, and do more. Right?
Right. Sanders' Medicare for All bill is fundamentally a single-payer program. It's one of the most, I think, refreshingly ambitious pieces of legislation I've ever read, which is pretty exciting.
Wow. Have you read a lot of legislation? Are you a legislation buff?
A lot of healthcare legislation. it's relatively interesting. And they use big font and it's double spaced. It's easy to scroll through. So you feel pretty accomplished for getting through a 98-page document in an hour.
But it's a fundamental, it really is. I mean, I've heard this. It's the only thing it has in common, let's say, with Cassidy Graham, is it is pretty radical.
Right.
Parachute, which I believe we've discussed. I genuinely love my Parachute sheets. The only ad I've ever gotten John to be on, my John, not you, John, or the other you, John.
A lot of Johns.
But my John. There's really, a lot of Johns.
Really, when you name your kid John, it's like, hey, maybe go for a second pitch, you know? What's the second idea? Most common name in history.
You know,
literally a book in the Bible.
It is a little confusing to me, like why you would name your children something that like literally, like if you say the name in a crowd, like a fourth of the men kind of turn to you. But, you know, hey.
It's like naming a dog Spot.
Except, I guess you have sort of like, that's a cool like retro thing to do. So is the name John. Anyway,
sure, it's coming back.
John loves them. We have the linen ones. We also recently got Parachute towels, which I guess are new.
Cool.
They are awesome. They're enormous, which you are a fellow smaller person, I think, like
okay.
me.
Yep.
And I don't know about you, but I really love it when like the towel like is basically like you could use it as a real sheet.
That's
like you
good.
Really wrap yourself
are
up.
You
in
a,
it,
are you a are you a know? One towel person or a two towel person?
Well, because I have the longer hair, I'm a two-towel person.
I have a system where I have they move through a cycle and they start as upper body towels and then they become lower body towels and then they're done. But I always have two. I find it's more, you know, I can wander around my house like some kind of a king or a sultan, you know?
Do you wrap one around your body and one around your shoulders?
Yes.
Or, okay. You don't do the turban thing because that's what that's like what I do.
No, I do not.
I imagine would also be a good look for you.
Barely hanging on to the hair that I have.
The parachute sheets are great. Parachute towels are great. They are fantastic quality, best fabrics materials, really modern design. The parachute sheets, pillowcases have the thing where they don't have a flap on the end. They work like a sham, you know, they have the sort of envelope style.
Oh, I like that. Cause then you're never all of a sudden realizing clothing. Like your hand is on like pillow, unprotected, you know, unguarded.
Exactly.
Who wants that?
Exactly. And it's like very, very neat look. It's a very like sort of, you know, posh hotel look.
Which, parachute. No, we I think like. They're great. And by the way, I think you might've just heard Pundit sniffling, but don't worry, you know, she's fine. She's fine. She's been to the vet. She's all checked out. So don't worry about that.
How does she feel about parachute? Does she love the parachute sheets?
She does love parachute sheets. She uses them 100% the same amount as I do.
I think the amount of cat hair on my parachute sheets will attest. Our cats love them too.
Cats, man.
And if you visit parachutehome.com/friends, you get free shipping and returns. I will also point out, if you return the sheets, which I do not think you will, they donate them to Habitat for Humanity.
Cool.
And they also do donations to the United Nations Foundation for Malaria Prevention Bed Nets. And you can actually do that donation yourself on the site when you buy sheets, which I have done for real. And again, promo code /friends at parachute.com for a 60-night trial.
Parachutehome.com. Is it a code friends or slash friends?
It's slash friends.
Slash
I always get the slash
friends.
And the code confused,
slash
but friends, basically.
Parachutehome.com/friends.
Your enthusiasm is infectious.
Oh, this is the thing that I love. I love this and my girlfriend, and she's a healthcare lawyer, so... Kind of get the best of both worlds.
And also, apparently, wrestling. You also love wrestling.
I do love wrestling. Wrestling is the highest form of theater. It is the only dramatic art that that I care about. I worked in the theater for a couple of years. I went to school in the theater scholarship, and then I discovered wrestling. And I grew up with it. My dad was a big Crush Losowski fan, and wrestling is the perfect. It's better than opera. Opera is really, really good for, like, I don't know, getting stoned and looking at. Like, that's pretty fun. But professional wrestling is, I think, it's a combination of like masculine drag and contemporary opera in a way that, I mean, it's stupid in ways that I think are beautiful. Dumb is good. And I love it so much.
I find it interesting and I want to talk to you more about it at some later date.
Great. Sweet.
But
jump ahead.
We're going to have to get back to,
the ACA.
Speaking of villains, speaking of theater. Speaking of, you know, people getting thrown to the mat again and again and again, but finally getting back up, let's talk about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All.
That sounds great. So the Affordable Care Act perpetuated this idea that health insurance is health care and that you need to like subsidize the private market in order to take care of it. You have a multi-payer model. You've got the profit motive in there. And that's just the way that healthcare works. The single payer movement, which has been fighting for decades now, I think scored a significant victory with the introduction of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill this year, and more importantly, with the immediate co-sponsorship of a third of the Democratic caucus, which is, I believe, unprecedented.
And everyone that's even thinking about 2020, everyone that's ever written 2020 in the margin of their, you know, Senate notebook.
Right.
2020 plus me.
Whether
those people.
Whether it's out of like a moral sense of moral obligation or just like, I don't know, naked opportunism. Like, I'm fine with that either way for right now, right? Like, people understand that suddenly we've gone, the Dems have gone from being the party that tells us that single payer will never, ever happen to the three folks that are most often thrown around for 2020 accepting or co-sponsoring Bernie's bill. Now, whether that's just like nominal co-sponsorship, whether they'll end up being like Anthony Rendon in California and like they'll back out of the actual progressiveness of it, like, is to be seen. But it is indicative of a broader movement that is being successful. It's creating the pressure. Like, there's
we moved the Overton window.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that is done.
We've thrown a brick through the Overton window, and it's good. Like a lot of that has to do with the counter protests against the ACA repeal mm-hmm. and replacement. There's a certain irony to the fact that Paul Ryan, of all people, ended up being the person that launched the most impassioned defense of the Affordable Care Act. via negativa, right? It wasn't until that mm-hmm. Paul Ryan threatened to gut and destroy the ACA that activists really took to town halls to fight, not just for keeping the ACA, but for expanding it and for building a more robust, universal, single-payer healthcare program. You've got the ADAPT activists that literally put their bodies in the line, chained themselves to people's offices. You've got town halls where folks across ages, races, and income levels are screaming at their senators, which, again, is very, very, very good. And it's all because the ACA bit off or sorry, the GOP bit off more than they could chew with repeal in place. Like, there's a certain irony to that fact. And it's also kind of lamentable that I think the Dems never really stood behind the ACA in the way that they ought to have. It was promised as an incremental step to a better healthcare model, but nobody ever took any steps afterward. It was just kind of the thing that we
in
had.
In a weird way, like, this did force Democrats to do that, right? Like, it forced us to reckon with what parts of the ACA worked and what parts didn't. And we have now, a lot of people have figured out it's the generous parts of the ACA that work.
Right.
So let's build on those.
Exactly.
And that's Medicare for All. And I want to get to some of the more exciting things about this bill. I feel like it's such a revolutionary thing in and of itself. Like, it just gets talked about in terms of, like, top line. Like, it's Medicare for All. It's a form of single payer. Yay. But I wonder if we could get in a little more detail about what exactly is so exciting about
Sure. So there's a couple of things that everyone knows about that are exciting. There are a couple of things that are in the bill that I think are really exciting. And then there's kind of the indication of what comes next, right? Like, single payer is a good thing. It's a great thing, but it is only step one in a very long process of achieving a new form of actual health justice in America. Things that are in Bernie's bill that are dope. It's ambitious. It kind of lays all of its cards on the table. Like, there is no pre-equivocation. There's no pre-compromise. It demands a bunch of things. Top line, particularly interesting to me, full federal funding for abortion, no exceptions. Great. It defines and expands an extensive set of essential health benefits, including reproductive care, vision, and dental care for all American residents, and gives authority to the Secretary of Health and Human Services to expand the definition of residents as they see fit. It has no cost sharing, no out-of-pocket costs, with the exception of a $250 per annual per year cap on prescription drugs, which I understand, but I don't like that. But still, that's substantially better than what high deductible plans give you.
I want to pause and just say about that reproductive health thing, that is needed so badly, and it would allow women to know that their reproductive health is cared for no matter who their insurer is. You know, no matter what they do for a living, which is right now kind of where we are.
Oh, yeah. Right. You know? Right now, I believe the majority of abortions in the U.S. are paid for out of pocket, and mm-hmm. a lot of out of pocket costs and out of pocket or like with assistance of like a fund. And if that creates an obvious like a income barrier to people, like the example that I'm most familiar with is a women or people that can give birth who live in, for example, El Paso, Texas, or rural Texas,
yep.
rural West Texas. I have to decide between whether, like, do I keep going to like my terrible minimum wage job, or do I get into a van to travel to New Mexico, which is a 2-3 day trip, and then come back, lose my job, but get the abortion that I need. The abortion that I want, like, that's obviously barbaric, and that's a particular burden we are inflicting exclusively on the people that are least equipped to handle it. Providing for abortion in a federal program is obviously humane and broadly like shifts kind of that distribution of suffering out of or removes kind of that this like.
Well, it also takes sort of, I think it sort of takes the language of suffering out of it too. It sort of also treats abortion as a healthcare right.
Oh, exactly. Like,
you know, and it's just as something that all people everywhere, if they can give birth, they also have a right not to give birth. And it's not something that you need to do on the sly. It's not something you need to be ashamed of.
Right.
It's not something that is a different than other kinds of healthcare, which is way it's conceptualized now. Right now, it's a thing that is defined by the federal government as different than any other kind of healthcare.
Right. It's just a fucking procedure. Like, it's just a fucking pill. Like, the idea of safe, legal, and rare is so pernicious. Who the fucking cares why you want to get an abortion? It's your body. It's your needs. And the idea of saying, oh, this is like a, like, the suffering I was referring to was like the suffering of like being forced to by your own government to either like get the abortion you want or quit your job and keep living like in the hell world we've built for people who can give birth, particularly in poor parts of the country.
I'm just sensitive to like calling, you know, I'm just sensitive to that. I should have known better than you. But maybe we need to move on. I just feel like it's not enough attention being paid to that particular aspect of the bill that is pretty revolutionary.
It makes me abortion access across the U.S. has been like gutted quickly and then slowly and then quickly again. And this finally like makes it pretty clear that abortion is just a fucking it is a relatively simple
medical procedure
with a
that like, you should be able to get wherever medical care is available.
Right.
It is not different.
Abortion
it
on demand, no question, federal funding. Like enough with like this capitulating safe, legal, rare bullshit that just like permits the idea that this is a harmful thing or a shameful thing. And that's bullshit. Like that does a lot of harm to a lot of people. This guts that. And there's a lot of other things in this bill too. That one's particularly compelling because obviously it flies, it undoes the Hyde Amendment. And the argument a lot of people make, including me, is that we can build the coalition, we can build the popular movement, we can build like the political momentum to pass single payer. And if we can do that, we can also build the political momentum to pass federal funding of abortion within it. These things go hand in hand. This is the vision of healthcare justice we want in America, and these things are inseparable. There is no division. There is no like pecking order of, oh, you got to do A to do B, or these things are different. No, they're not different. They're the same. It's healthcare. This is just fucking healthcare. This is the same thing as getting a flu shot or getting a tonsillectomy. Well, not like tonsillectomy are kind of bullshit. Same thing as getting like an appendectomy or whatever. It's just a fucking, it's part of healthcare. It is not an independent separate thing. You're exactly right when you describe it that way.
And I think that that's also kind of in miniature the way that this bill works and in shifting the way we think about healthcare, which is that it is a basic, I mean, we can argue over whether you want to use the term right, but that it is something that all Americans get, and that we do not make us, you know, stratify it. We do not decide who deserves it. We say Americans get healthcare.
Right.
And then we provide that health, and then we set up a system that provides that healthcare. There is no means testing. There is no judgment about what kind of healthcare, like why you're going to get the healthcare you're going to get. And no employer is allowed to tell you, you know, what kind of healthcare you deserve or don't deserve. And people are untethered from this idea of employer-based healthcare, which is like radical for us, but the norm in the rest of the world.
Right. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that the status quo the ACA advocates is one of total employer domination on your body, right? Like your employer gets to decide whether or not you have access to contraception, whether or not you have access to hormone therapy, whether or not you have access to like fucking blood transfusions. And that's kind of like, that's the norm. The encroaching employer, full complete employer domination, not just of your well-being in the financial sense, but also in the physical sense. That's what the ACA represents. This is a significant break from that. It also includes like, it's a really, really well thought out bill. It includes a fair transition for the relatively small number of displaced insurance administrative workers. That's a thing unions have developed for a long time. It's we're just like, even if no other costs changed at all, a single payer program saves at least $200 billion a year in pure administrative costs. We can take that money and use it to train the folks that might be displaced, to give them give them a golden parachute, subsidize regular folks, let them like live comfortably, or give them training, put them in new places. Like when reallocation happens in the private sector, when Silicon Valley invents, I don't know, like an automatic fuck, man, automatic car or something, something dumb, automatic laundry machine, and it displaces a ton of workers. We don't demand or we don't expect any kind of reallocation or training. We permit that as like the natural ebb and flow of the market. Here, someone's thinking ahead and saying, we actually can spend this money to like make sure that people are treated fairly and justly for the rest of their working life if they choose to work, which is dope. It also includes, very excitingly for me, it reinvests a bunch of money in the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the AHRQ, which is dope, right? Like, I'll go really, really brief on this, but I think this is super exciting. One of the things that we just need in the U.S. is a standard for how healthcare data is collected and stored, and also a standard for like what a doctor does when you see them. Right now, like what a doctor does to you, or what a provider chooses to do, is predicated upon like their training, their intuition, marketing to them, and like the general tendencies of their hospital. The same doctor, if this is a study that was done, was pretty remarkable. In the 70s, continues today. A given doctor, the same doctor, in two different hospitals, one that has a lot of beds and one that has a smaller number of beds, will admit more patient to inpatient surgery in the hospital with more beds than in the hospital with fewer beds, right? Like there's facility. And the reason for that is because like there's this thing called Romer's Law. If a hospital builds a bed, it will fill it because hospitals get paid when people are in their beds. They get paid through Medicare. They get paid through insurers or whatever. And so a facility with more ability to take in patients will pump more folks in. And doctors aren't necessarily choosing to do this. It's a subconscious bias. But like there's no like hard and fast rule for like what should you do when you see a given person, right? Like the level of, and it's called evidence-based guidelines for what a doctor does or does not do when they see a patient hasn't really been built. Like the entire healthcare model we have now, the entire hospital level model we have now is less than 100 years old. All these things are much newer and more in flux than we think before. Another good example is tonsillectomy rates. There's a famous study in Vermont about tonsillectomy rates in Vermont, which is a relatively homogenous state. County to county, tonsillectomy rates among like the same number of people that are sick with the same conditions vary by up to like 3 or 4x. Sorry, up to 7x. Like it's like there's no rule book saying like if patient has A, B, and C, do D, E, or F. Finally,
Atul Gawande has written a lot about this.
Yep,
right?
Yep.
He's written a lot about also like the need for standardization and checklists,
exactly.
and using evidence to create pathways of care that everyone can hew to, and you can decide what the best outcomes are.
Yep.
And also that, and we should point out for people that think about this stuff, that helps control costs.
Exactly. Oh yeah, that's the cool part. So
if you're thinking about money, we got an answer for you too.
One of the problems of healthcare costs in the U.S. is you've got two things. You've got unit costs, like an MRI costs 5x a year what it costs in Australia, and you've got utilization costs, right? A person who goes to the hospital and is given the wrong procedure is not given adequate follow through will be readmitted down the road, and that costs a bunch of money. Or a provider might be incentivized to give somebody an MRA or a test or a scan or a shot they don't need. One, to cover their butt on like the fear of malpractice, but two, like because they get paid per unit of care they provide, so costs go up even though actual like outcomes and actual quality don't increase. Like at a certain point, like the amount of healthcare a person uses, quote unquote, like how often they're in the hospital, how often they're admitted, doesn't really have an effect on like the overall outcome, like the quality of the care they get. And so if a single payer sets rules of, hey, when A happens, do B, C, D, it can begin paying on those models, right? That's really exciting because suddenly we have like an organization that's being explicitly called out and given funding. Right now the AHRQ gets 1%, I think, of NIH funds, and NIH funds are constantly being besieged. Finally, they're getting money to build the stuff, like to build the models of what healthcare should look like. That one gives doctors some comfort because all of a sudden they're protected from malpractice by having a checklist they can follow. And two, like gives the payer some comfort because they know that like when a person presents with a broken hip or bronchitis or a pulmonary embolism or whatever, like we understand the things that go into the care of that. And we can build a payment model that adequately reflects those costs and then can be adjusted for how sick the person is otherwise, how old they are, where you, whatever. It's good. It's so fucking good. And it's hidden like 3/4 of the way down in Bernie's bill. I read it and I got, I mean, that's basically pornographic to me. That's so exciting.
There is a ritual. There is a ritual for your keys.
For your keys.
There's a ritual for almost everything, but there's definitely a ritual to looking for your keys.
Where are they, you said?
Where do you check first?
Me?
Yeah.
I check, so here's where my keys can be. They can either be on my dining room table. They can be on the couch that closest to the door, but fall between the cushion and the back of the couch. They can be in my pants pocket. They can be in the bathroom. They can be at my bedside table. They can be in the fridge. They can be in my car. They can be in my bag. Or they could be just gone.
God, John, I think you do need tracker.
I think like, I need tracker. Like
that's a wide variety of places you need to look for your keys. I was going to ask for the strangest place you've ever found them, but maybe I don't want to. For me, I thought I was bad, but the strangest place I've ever found my keys is probably the refrigerator. I have genuinely found them in the refrigerator before.
I can definitely I can definitely have a soda in my hand and my phone and my keys can be in the fridge. That'll happen.
Right. A tracker is a tracking device, obviously, and it's Tracker, TRACKR. And they released the first tracking device 8 years ago. They have a new Tracker Pixel. It is tiny. It is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. And you can put Tracker on anything you tend to lose, which would include keys. What else do you lose? I lose kind of everything, like wallet. I have my phone all the time, my iPad. What else? Do you lose stuff? You're not a loser of stuff? It sounded like you were with the keys thing.
I do okay. I don't think, I think my personality would suggest that I lose things more than I do.
Huh. I'm glad to hear that. I don't know. I always feel like I'm the person that loses things. My husband's my living tracker thing. My marriage might go a little bit better if I had more of these things. You use your smartphone to find the thing that you've lost. So I guess you actually... Oh, wait. You know what? You can use the tracker to find your smartphone, it says here. You just press the button on the tracker and the phone rings, even if it's on silent. So I need to get one of these in my life. And you can locate your item even if it's miles away because Tracker uses a crowdsourcing location network. It is the largest in the world. They say it's like Waze, but for finding things.
Cool.
You live in LA, you might probably use Waze. So that might mean more to you than it does to me. Here is not so bad.
I use Google Maps. It's the same.
And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you truly have nothing to lose. And listeners of the program will get 20% off any order if they go to thetracker.com/friends. That's thetracker.com, thetracker.com.
So it's thetracker.com/friends, but there's no E in tracker.
There's no E in tracker, and there's a V before tracker.
But there's a V.
And you have to go to /friends. And you get 20% off. So do it. I would ask you a question that I actually don't know the answer to about this bill, which is I'm in recovery, part of the recovery community. And so, opioid epidemic funding and care, and I actually think of it more as an addiction epidemic, is something I've been paying attention to. And one of the evil things about Cassidy Graham, obviously, is it cuts that. How does single payer impact that health problem?
Oh, okay, cool. You set me up for a thing that I really wanted to talk about, which is the idea of health justice. I promise I will get to that. Here's how I'm going to get there. Right now, we all, as a society, as a government which represents our society, we all bear the costs of when people get sick, when people suffer, when people die unnecessarily. When people suffer and die from preventable conditions, when people, like a cardiac failure that comes from diabetes, from lack of nutrition, we suffer together when people suffer and die from addictions that they weren't able to get help to manage, or when they're when the only... tools they have available to them are things like unclean needles, and so they get comorbidities like Hep C. When we suffer together, when people die from any kind of preventable condition, whether physical in their body or in the world around them. We already like all suffer from that thing. And the government bears the costs of that down the road. Either because your insurer doesn't give a fuck about you, right? Once you change plans or age out or become too poor to get insured, like you're no longer their problem. But the government does kind of bear those costs, right? Either once you turn 65, they're on the hook for all that spending. If you're below a certain income level in a certain state, they're on the hook for all that spending. And fundamentally, like this has massive implications for like the health of their country. And whether you want to get like quantitative like that.
I was going to say the opioid epidemic, the number I think gets thrown around is it costs like $71 billion a year.
It is some
in terms of missed work, emotional and medical costs, all that.
I remember reading a paper, I think it was, we need to spend an additional 96 to begin treating it thoroughly. And that's just to compensate. I don't cut this part out. I'll see if I can find this thing and I can send it to you. But somebody put together like an accurate projection of
no, I think that's
how
right.
much
I
it
think
would
that's
cost
96
to actually
billion.
Treat this thing.
I'm pretty sure that was the start.
It was it was the beginning of care, not the actual like full course of it. It was $96 billion dollars. Opioid addictions are a problem that have comorbidities, right? Opioid addiction can lead to hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is really expensive to treat. It can go hand in hand with HIV/AIDS through a needle sharing. That causes
foster care. It puts kids into foster care.
You've got kids that are left to themselves.
Which is a federal, which the government winds up paying for.
Right.
Because
and then you've got like the fucking carceralism of it, right? We just throw, because we don't want to build the healthcare program to take care of folks, we just throw them into jail and that's where the costs go. And that is compounding costs because then people are out of the workforce and their families suffer. Like all these problems are interconnected and we all together as a society or through our government bear the costs of those, right? Either in the financial sense through like having to pay for these things or like in like the emotional, like moral sense of we watch people around us suffer and die and it's our families, it's our friends, it's people around us, and that sucks. So we already bear those costs. But what a single payer does is a single payer compels caring for like the costs of providing care to the government as well, right? So the entire scope of why these things happen and where these costs go, both in the financial and moral sense, are now fully within the domain of the federal single payer. And that does a lot, right? Because if your population is getting sick and your population is dying because they are suffering from an addiction epidemic, then investing in addiction therapy, investing in treatment becomes a form of healthcare, and you invest in therapy and treatment to bring healthcare long-term costs down. If your
like residential treatment, the cost of residential treatment becomes something that it's worth it for the government to bear, because that's right now the thing that, tends to work. I'll say I went to residential treatment. I definitely needed it.
Humane local therapy is better now and much, much better downstream. Like it's an obvious thing that only a single payer can really begin leaning toward.
Right. And all the other kinds of courses of treatment that I have, I will just say I have some mixed feelings about some of the medical assisted stuff, but it's important to have as part of the recipe and important to study it.
Right.
Which is also what you can do under single payer, which is like right now all the opioid replacement stuff is really kind of tightly held and parceled out to people. And it deserves to be used as much as it can be and to be studied. So it starts that part of it becomes possible too.
Instead of delegating this problem to like fucking cops in small communities across the Northeast and the Appalachian region, like it is a national epidemic and it's a thing that needs to be studied. We need to evaluate what to do and we need to like put the money into like taking care of people as early as possible in ways that don't fucking ruin their lives or the lives of people around them down the road. And we can do that. And we can also like, that's both the correct thing to do like as a moral community, and it's the correct thing to do like from straight up fiscal incentives of taking care of people early so they don't get sicker later.
Obviously, this is something issue I care about a lot. And it's this epidemic, 250% increase, I think, in the past 15 years in overdose deaths. We are in desperate times and we need to be able to use desperate measures. A single payer plan would give us the tools to do that, like open, let's say, safe injection sites.
Right.
And allow for supervised use so that people don't die from overdoses.
It is both the obvious responsible, and I guess not both three, and like moral thing to do. And I mean, but that idea, this idea of treating the opioid, the addiction epidemic as a healthcare, as a problem to be resolved through healthcare, then investing in healthcare, like that extends, right?
Right.
If your population is getting sick and they're population is dying because the places they live aren't adequate. They live in substandard housing, like the Grenfell Towers or the Ghost Ship warehouse in Oakland. Only middle class people. There was a talk in Oakland. There was a good line that I heard. Only middle class people die, and poor people die in fires. Nobody wealthy ever dies in the fire. If people live in substandard housing, it's polluted. It's unsafe. Or they don't have housing at all, no adequate housing, you die much, much quicker of exposure than you do cancer, then providing housing becomes a form of healthcare. And you provide cheap, affordable, subsidized housing to bring healthcare costs down. If folks are getting sick and folks are getting dying because the food they have access to is unnutritious or makes them sick, or they don't have access to healthy food, or the healthy food near them is super unaffordable because carrots cost $6, then and they're getting sick and they're dying from it. They're getting diabetes. Diabetes turns into cardiac failure. Then providing free or subsidized nutritious food and the space and the time to cook it becomes a form of healthcare. And you pay and you fund food to bring healthcare costs down. All these ideas are interconnected, right? This is the fundamental idea of health justice. And I find it extremely compelling, right? Like all these different problems, opioid or addiction epidemic, food deserts, substandard housing, domestic assault, domestic violence, police brutality, all these things are interconnected. And the multi-payer for-profit model has proven itself inadequate, unable, and unwilling to even consider addressing these things. A single payer does not in and of itself tackle these problems, but it finally gives us the tools and the leverage to joust at it. And that's so fucking cool.
And I'm going to ask you a question that I know you've been asked before because I've asked it, but I think other people might want to hear the answer, which is that how one response by someone with libertarian-ish concerns to the picture you're describing would be, oh, you're getting government involved in my life too much. They're going to outlaw French fries. They're going to outlaw Sundays. Government's going to be telling me what I can and can't do with my body. I have a feeling I know what your answer is. So please.
I would say to that person, hey, shut up, nerd. Check this out. We already we already have organizations that tell us what we can and can't do with our bodies. We just delegate it to private corporations that aren't accountable to us, right? We've given like, oh shit. Okay. So there's two things, two examples of that. One, what we talked about before, total employer dominance, of your healthcare. Your employer gets to choose how much your healthcare costs, what you have access to, what you do and do not get to have, where you can and cannot go. That fucking sucks. Secondly, like insurers themselves also regulate what kinds of care you have access to and don't have access to. There's a lawsuit in Florida that under Section 1557 of the ACA, which is just kind of a stapling together of things like Title IX and other protected class laws, there was a lawsuit articulating the idea that someone's pre-existing conditions are protected class. You can't deny someone access to care based upon what conditions they have. Insurers were doing a thing, I think it was, no, I'm not positive, where they were making... So you have a drug formulary, which is like how much a given tier of drugs cost, whatever, usually generics on the bottom and cancer drugs are up top. They were taking these 16 drugs used to treat HIV/AIDS and spreading them across the formulary, not including some, putting some way up top, really making having insurance or having their particular plan of insurance unfeasible or untenable or extremely expensive for a person with HIV/AIDS. That's one step. Second step was there was a case where... an insurer was requiring prior authorization on Truvada, which is a prophylactic, it's like PrEP drug for people who might get HIV/AIDS. It helps protect against contracting it. Prior authorization means your doctor has to call your insurer and your insurer gives the thumbs up or the thumbs down. And this insurer was denying people access to a preventative drug because they were, quote, it was indicative that they were, quote, engaging in high risk homosexual behavior. They said someone couldn't get insured, couldn't get a preventive drug because the insurer thought they might be too gay to get it. That's barbaric. And like that sounds like a joke, but that's literally the policy that they enacted. We've let these private companies tell us what healthcare we're allowed to have or not have. A thing like PrEP is a no-brainer. Nationalize it, buy it out, give it to everyone. No one should, like, we've solved HIV/AIDS. We have drugs that prevent you from getting it. We have therapies that and treatment plans that mitigate the effects if you do get it. And this insurer chose, like, no single payer would deny somebody preventive medicine if they thought they needed it. That's literally the first thing you do when you're building a healthcare model is find out ways to give primary preventive care to people to prevent things that cause costs down the road. But no, because we have chosen to let private companies that operate not in our interest, but that those of their investors or of their if they're closely held of their owners dictate what care looks like in America and who is permitted to have it. We have built this hell world that we live in now, and it primarily affects those who are already vulnerable. So fuck off, nerd. By making the government accountable to determine like what kind of care looks like, we make our representatives accountable for it. Right? That's a much a more optimistic vision of how a country works than letting a bunch of fucking CEOs tell us what care we can and can't have.
I think when people talk about being worried about government controlling our lives too much, they forget that we're the government. And I don't see a future in which Americans are going to allow their senators and representatives to outlaw French fries. I just
right, gotta have those
don't
fries.
Think it's going to happen. Yeah. All right, Tim. Thank you so much. I think this is where we can wrap up. I hope that we have a chance to talk again, because I hope that this single payer bill continues to be a part of our national conversation, if not actually enacted anytime soon, probably not. And I hope we never talk about Cassidy Graham again.
Yeah,
goes away.
Drowns in the bathtub of history and we can forget about it.
Yeah. Anyway, so you also, you're on a speaking tour. Is there a website that people can go to or follow you on Twitter?
I'm pretty shotgun. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Krulge, C-R-U-L-G-E. It's a nonsense word. I wrote a script to find the shortest non-word I could on Twitter, and I made that my username. I have a newsletter that I send out about once every other week. It's healthcare policy news and things that I think are particularly interesting. I wrote about Sanders' bill last night around 5 in the morning. Did some stuff on Cassidy Graham, which other shit. It's if you go to tinyletter.com/error, E-R-R-O-R, I got the first username. Or I got an early username. And then most newly of all, that's a word, my partner and I have put together a podcast on healthcare policy and metal music. She is a healthcare lawyer who works primarily on reproductive justice and working with people who are working on trans healthcare. She's much smarter than I am, and I'm a general. I'm really interested in payment reform and payment structuring. It's called Heavy Medical, Heavy X Medical. All these things are on my Twitter. I link them all there. But we both like metal music. We both like healthcare justice. And about every other week or so, we talk about both those things until. We pick a given topic, we pick a given white paper, discuss them, and then find a metal band we like and explain why they kick ass for about 5 minutes.
For people who find the weeds like too lightweight, like that, you're the solution for that.
Yeah. There are some parts.
If you think Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias like don't take things seriously enough, don't get into it, and really grapple with the issues, like
if to make the weeds comparison, I would say heavy medical is a lot like weeds, but without the knee-jerk iconoclasm, and instead a sense of unbridled optimism about what things can be possible and what things must be possible.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim. It was really fun talking to you.
Thank you.
And that is it for the show. As usual, you can follow the show on Twitter @crooked_friends. You can follow me on Twitter @AnnaMarieCox. And you can write to the show. We accept questions and problems from people that might want the help of the show, meaning me and usually a guest, in figuring out how to deal with politics and relationships and relationships and politics, any difficult or awkward conversations you may be having in your life or want to be having in your life. And that email address for the show is withfriendslikepod@gmail.com. Again, that's withfriendslikepod@gmail.com. And if you want to include an audio version of your question, that would be awesome. If you don't, just please include some contact info because we might ask you for an audio version or just ask you for permission to make an audio version. Keep fighting the good fight, guys. We're almost there. Change is coming. Have a great weekend.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.